Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I am beyond thrilled and honored to have George Smart on the show today. Hello, George.
Hello. Mid-Century Modern Monique.
Well,
that's alliterative. Yes.
Mr. Modernism yourself. I mean, I am so happy that you're here, and this is a dream come true for me. And you started it all, by the way, Mr. Podcast.
Oh, what did I do?
Mr. U.S. Modernist Podcast. So George is the founder and CEO of U.S. Modernist, which is the world's largest nonprofit educational archive dedicated to the documentation, preservation, and promotion of modernist residential design. And you have so many, there's 20,000 modernist houses that you have documented this, and you have architects and a library that has scanned over 4.1 million pages of architectural
magazines. Maybe 4.2 by the time we hear this podcast.
So you really have been this, you know, you've put together this puzzle of this world of modernism. And I wanted to start by asking you how this started. How did you become this epicenter of all things mid-century modern?
Well, the story is, it was a dark and stormy night in January of 2007.
Right.
And I was minding my own business in a completely different career doing strategic planning for companies. Mm. I was thinking about building a new house. Mm. So I went to Google. Mm. I typed in modernist houses. And what I found right away were about five modernist houses from the 50s. That's my jet flying over. Five modernist houses from the 50s that were in Raleigh that I had never seen before. Mm. And I thought, well, that's weird because my dad was an architect and I lived in Raleigh my whole life, and Raleigh wasn't that big a town in the 50s and 60s. So about 3 hours later, I had this out-of-body experience, like on Alien, where that little monster erupts from the guy's stomach.
Oh, no.
And architecture bursts from my DNA. And I realized that my dad had taken me to these houses when I was 6 years old. And I'd been there before. So I thought, well, this is really great. You know, it's kind of fun. Nothing special. I'll take a yellow pad and I'll just write down these houses. And I'll get some more on the list and maybe go drive by and see them.
Right.
Well, my dad, who had passed away by then, had a bunch of 80-year-old friends who I called and said, I found these houses. Are there any more that you know of? And they go, oh, yeah, there are hundreds of them around Raleigh.
Right.
If you come by and pick me up and drive me around, I'll show you where they are. So I get in my Mini Cooper and go pick up these 80-year-old architects, and they would hold the iPhone out the window and take photos of the houses, and we would jot down the address, and then afterwards we'd go have martinis. And this happened for about, like, you know, a month. And we got up to 50 or 60 houses.
Wow.
And then people said, oh, well, you should have a website. Mm. Well, a website is easy to throw together if you don't really care. You can just, there's so many tools now.
Right.
So I just threw it together. It's a website for me. It's a website for one, like Soup for One by Campbell's. And all of a sudden, people got on the website, and they were really interested in these houses in Raleigh. Mm. I think every town has its own history, and people who grew up there or lived there a long time wanted to know more about the houses, and their number one request was, let's have a tour.
Yes.
So in 2008, I put together a tour just for the hell of it. I thought 50 people would come. We had about 200, 250 people that showed up for it, sold out. And now that was probably 150 tours ago that we've done since then around every major city in North Carolina, different places in the nation, L.A., Palm Springs, Chicago, New York, New Canaan, Connecticut, Columbus, Indiana, all the epicenters of modernism, Plus, we've taken people to Europe, to Scandinavia, and to Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
Wow. And you've done lectures, you've done talks, you've educated so many people about these homes. You do, I know, Palm Springs, we've hung out there a million times, and you've taken people through different John Lautner properties.
Yeah.
And just amazing designs that no one would have the opportunity to see if it was not for you. So I wanted to ask you how this network of people has come together. You have a lot of volunteers, and you have a lot of people like me who are, you know, want to support you 110%. So yeah. What can we all do to support you besides going to usmodernist.org and donating and helping there, volunteering? What is it that you really need from people?
Well, the goal of all this, of everything we do ultimately, is to keep these houses from being destroyed. That's it. And what most people don't understand is that advocacy has to start at the point that the house goes vacant, not at the point when some developer is coming along with a bulldozer to tear it down. And it's easy to blame the developers, but it's really not their fault. They're just doing what they do in the life cycle of a house. But 3 years earlier, when the old lady dies, or the heirs are fighting about it, or it otherwise goes empty, that's the time for the neighbors and the family and friends, instead of saying to themselves, oh, let's just wait and see what happens, to actually be in action about getting the house occupied.
Correct.
Getting it rented on a short-term basis. We've even helped people get house sitters to just have somebody in there. Because if a house is empty for any period of time, it deteriorates very, very rapidly.
Yes.
And becomes the kind of condition that it's going to get sold to a developer at some price and it's going to get knocked down.
Right. Well, we've seen it so many times when people say, oh, you know, we don't know if we can keep the house because land value is going to be more of, you know, we're going to get a higher price. And they let these homes go. And, you know, if you want the highest price per square foot, you have to take care of the home and you have to have a realtor that will prep the home, make it look great, and show it as a house that someone can remodel or live in. That's why I started my company, because so many realtors just mark them as land.
Right. See, unfortunately, not many realtors are like you, Monique, who understand this stuff. They just think it's some wonky house with some weird seller, and we just want to, you know, dispense with this whole thing so we can get somebody to come in and build a $4 million home on top of it.
Right. Well, we've sold a lot of these homes for much higher than even the highest price per square foot in the neighborhood, and people don't realize that. Some people that do not understand the architecture will say, how the heck did you sell that old crappy house for this price? Well, it was a famous architectural masterpiece. That's how.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful that you're doing that for the community. You have been, I call you a Sherlock Holmes. I think I've called you that for about 9 years now, because you find people. I don't know how you find them. You know, sons of architects, daughters of
architects.
Lots of
children of architects. Grandchildren, ex-lovers.
You find these people, and you find the plans for the home. You find all this architectural information. Can you share with us some stories about this? That it just boggles my mind how you find people.
Oh, sure. Well, we have lots of informal volunteers, people who just write me. My favorite thing in the morning is to get up, and I have 4 or 5 emails every single day. So that's a couple thousand a year.
Right.
Where somebody somewhere I've never heard of before has sent me a photo of a house or a location of a house or a little tidbit about a house, and I just pour that into this giant maw, which is our website. And the jigsaw pieces just keep coming together.
Right.
So ultimately, all that data becomes very useful information.
Yes.
We organize a website differently than almost anybody else. Most preservation websites are organized by geography.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in Cincinnati, you go and find all the houses in Cincinnati and figure out who the architects were. But for us, we're trying to really establish more of a lineage of what the architect did over their career, and to find all those houses that were never famous, never published, maybe even never got known. And there are lots and lots and lots of those because not every architect got to be published.
Right.
In fact, the bulk of modernist houses in America are by architects that maybe did four or five of them in their whole careers because they couldn't get clients that were brave enough to want to try this new style.
Right. Well, sort of like this home here, Alan Blair was the architect who did this home, and he only did five. And the design is so amazing. You know, you wish you could document all of these and make them available to other people. Are there architects that have reached out to you to show you their designs in different cities, or is it mostly research that you do?
Well, a little bit of both. Mostly it's architects' families. For instance, there's a fellow named William Whiffler, who was a very well-known architect here in the Bay Area.
I know his sons.
Right.
Yes.
And his sons called me up and said, you know, our dad was really great. He's not on your site. Can we put him on the site?
Yes.
Well, we have a long backlog of things we're already working for.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to try to say yes whenever I can. So I said, well, look, I'll show you the format that we have for each of these profiles. If you'll write it up, I'll put it on the site. Right. And about 2 weeks later, I got this Word document with everything in our format and all the photos. And 5 minutes later, William Whiffler is now up on the site and is getting fully indexed and searched just like Frank Lloyd Wright.
I love that. And in this community, you have brought so many people together. I mean, you've introduced me to Kelly Lynch, to Trina Turk, to all of us, Leo Marmel, who's on the board also, your advisory board. We are all so passionate about this architecture. And you have a lot of new folks, a new team that has signed on to help you to provide more events. What is up next for you for these events, specifically in Palm Springs? We have a lot of listeners that are down
there.
Sure.
Well, we are 17 years old now. As I said, my background was in consulting. A lot of the work that I did was in succession planning. So I am thinking 5-10 years ahead, when I won't be director anymore, somebody else will be in it. We need to have for this organization a very strong financial endowment that will spin off money for the administrative costs. So to do that, we're doing two things. One is we're having a capital campaign where people can donate and endow certain portions of the work that we do. And secondly, we have these wild, wonderful modernist parties called Moon Over Modernism.
Yes.
That we're doing all around the country, where people can come on a weekend and they can go to a fabulous evening event with music and food and drinks and all of that at a splendid modernist house most people don't get into.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day on Sunday, we'll be at a smaller house all day, where people can come and experience more of the detailing that goes on.
Yes.
So for instance, last year, our first Moon Over Modernism was at the Sheets Goldstein House in Los Angeles.
Amazing.
Famous for the Big Lebowski.
Yes.
Which people just went nuts over that.
Yeah.
And the next day, we were at what I think is Los Angeles' most famous house, the Stahl House, up in the hills on Woods Drive.
Oh, amazing.
Little tiny place, 1,700 square feet with this pristine little pool and the floor-to-ceiling glass windows.
Mm.
And people go through all of the houses that we have on tour, and you can just see the happiness flowing out of them. They're just so thrilled to be there for different reasons. I mean, some are just fans. Some are aspiring to have a modernist home of their own. Some of them grew up in one and no longer do. We have a case sometimes of the dueling spouses, where you've got one modernist and one classicist, and the modernist drags the classicist to the tour and tries to convince them of the advantages.
It never works. It does work sometimes.
There are ways to persuade the errant spouse.
There are ways.
Yes.
Well, it's sort of, for me, I think it's a dream come true to walk through these homes that you've idolized and looked at and seen in magazines and photos online. It's just this world of, you know, the future and the past meshed into one.
Well, part of it is that no video or even VR can give you the experience of being there and feeling the vibe, the emotions of the space. I first learned this when I went to Falling Water in Mill Run, Pennsylvania, which is middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. And that's Frank Lloyd Wright's 1930s masterpiece that cost like $130,000 to build and $11 million to fix later on, because he wasn't the best engineer in the world. But it's his great masterpiece, and there have been zillions of photos and videos of it. But you don't really get it until you walk in that front door and start experiencing all the different levels and how he was weaving the flow of people through their daily lives. A lot of these early architects, something they would do with some of their clients was to either send them detailed questionnaires on how their life goes in a typical day, or they, in the case of Richard Neutra, he would go and live with the family for a couple of days and make observations.
Against their wishes.
No, they wanted.
I'm sure they liked it. Yeah. It was probably fun, but.
Yeah, a little different.
Yes. To see how a home moves, to see where the sun, you know, enters the home, to see where the landscape would best be.
Well, also things like, when do you get up in the morning? You know, what kind of food preparation do you do as a family? What kind of rituals do you have? Do you entertain? Do you have special hobbies that need special rooms to accommodate those hobbies? Do you need to have space for certain kind of vehicles, and how much? Right. And then particularly if it's on a tightly constrained lot, how do you stack all this stuff together so it doesn't look ugly, right?
Well, the majority of these homes that I've seen and sold and helped clients with, they're on really large pieces of land. So they are targets for developers.
Yeah,
That's the issue. And mostly these homes were smaller. They were built smaller. You know, of course, there are larger custom homes. But the average square footage doesn't go more than 2,500 square feet for the majority of these. So I think it's really interesting. And it's so special to me to meet people that want to keep this architecture and preserve it. And your group, who I've met and talked with through these various amazing parties that you throw, all of us have the same goal of restoring the homes, bringing them back to their, you know, original design and keeping that original design. Do you have access to these things for people that need to know, let's say, for instance, they have a home with the same architect or want inspiration on what to do? Do you have these things that you could give them or sell them or provide?
You mean resources to restore the house?
Yes.
Well, that's our magazine library.
Yes.
So we have 4.1, 4.2 million pages of architecture magazines going back 130 years, all scanned, and now all text searchable for the first time.
That's amazing.
So if your house or your architect was ever published, you can find it. You can see the original articles, and you can see the photographs from that time. So if your house was in a magazine, you can see how it looked. You can get some ideas from that. But where people really benefit is from the ads that are in the magazine at the time, because they're all the contemporaneous things that were going in these houses.
Right.
For instance, you know, the internet of its day, The Bitcoin of the era was these things called radiant floors.
Yes.
Where you'd have a concrete floor with these pipes running through it. And you'd shoot hot water through it when it got cold. And it would provide heat that would come off the floor, heat the whole house, and the floor was very toasty. And this was like the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
They
the
did
most
break.
High tech.
They did break a lot. But you know, that's what happened. Room-to-room intercoms were very sexy in the 40s and 50s. Everyone wanted those. Everyone wanted a drop-down hi-fi in their living room, which was this little wooden panel that was flush against the wall, and you'd press it, and it would drop down. There'd be a turntable with an AM-FM radio attached to the side and big-ass speakers built into the wall. Not these little tiny things like we have now, Right. But like 2 foot by 3 foot speakers.
Just massive.
Massive speakers. So that people could have, you know, music and entertain.
Right, right.
And, you know, if you want to take the house back to that, you can find, like, are these suppliers still in business? Mm-hmm. Or is there an eBay marketplace somewhere for these?
Right.
I get a lot of phone calls from people that want advice on, like, you know, how do I take it back? Should I take it back? And mm-hmm. and my answer is really pretty pragmatic. I mean, I have a very low bar for this. I just want them not to screw up the house.
Thank you.
Right?
That's right.
So if they want to take it back to 1954, great. Mm-hmm. If they don't and they want to put a lot of new, jazzy, modern things in it, that's fine. Because 20 years from now, someone's going to buy it from them and take it back to 1954 then.
Right.
It just kind of cycles through these
yes.
evolutions.
That's exactly
with the house.
Right.
So as long as you don't, you know, do major structural changes to it or completely rip out all the materials and put in something else or fall victim to what I call the Priscilla Presley syndrome, mm-hmm. where she took a perfectly wonderful John Lautner house and put an Italianate villa in it, basically turned it into that.
Right.
You know, the moral of that story is go buy a villa.
Go
somewhere.
Buy a villa.
Yeah.
Please
go buy a villa.
There are many other architectural styles
to choose from.
You don't need to ruin a modernist house to
yeah.
create that. Well, we were looking at my dumbwaiter a little bit ago, and it's just so funny. As you're saying, there are just, it's so rare to find vendors that will supply these things.
Yeah.
So, you know, eBay.
It's not a dumbwaiter, it's a grill.
But it acts as a dumbwaiter.
Oh, does it go up to the, it goes all the way down to the bottom?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't see that part.
So, you know, these features that someone has tried to hide or change, or I've found that a lot of buyers, and particularly ones, you know, around here in the Bay Area that are work in design, they're so interested in what the original design was
yeah.
that they want to, you know, find that out and make sure it's still there. And they're interested in the original. Anything that's added or hidden or changed doesn't feel the same.
Well, you know, again, it really depends. I mean, a lot of couples, mm-hmm. They just have very specific needs and they aren't necessarily into the purism of modernism. Mm-hmm. They just like the general vibe of it, which
right.
is fine.
Right, right.
You know, I find that sometimes those original features turn people off because they don't know what it is. They don't know how to appreciate it. So when mm-hmm. I've gone into houses that have these, you know, room-to-room intercom systems, I will crank up some FM station or AM station, really, some old AM station, 530 on the dial, and people can hear.
Blast it.
Can hear, like, oh, so that's what that panel is
yes,
in the
yes,
wall.
Yes.
That's what that does. And then I'll press the intercom button and call them from the other room and go, Watson,
hello?
I need you.
Hello? Where are you? No, that's really interesting that you see, you and I'm a purist, so I love those things and I seek them out, actually. And I think it's just interesting to get to the bones of a house like this and, you know, find out what the original intent was. For people that have a lot of information, we were talking about your archives, and for people that contact you that have, let's say, a bunch of house plans, old magazines, architectural files, how can they get these to you?
Okay.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people, a lot of heirs, clients of mine that are heirs of these homes, just want to know where to send
where
them.
Where to send it. Well,
so,
much as my wife hates it, people do show up at our front door with boxes in hand. Sometimes trucks
yes.
show up at our driveway with many, many boxes.
Right, right.
We only take certain things. We take any kind of digital material, photos, slides, Super 8, zip drives, 3.5-inch floppies, 5-inch floppies, any kind of digital media, because we want to get the photos off of that just to save that for the future. We also look for project lists from architects' families, because that gives us a roadmap to try to find everything that architect put out. But ultimately, for things like plans, Those need to be in climate control storage someplace. And the best location for that is going to be typically the university where the architect went to school. They're going to be the ones most interested in retaining the work of their alumni. So if we happen to get physical items like plans, we just ferry them on to the university involved, and we advise families on how to set that up with the special collections group in that university.
Okay. So those of you listening, you can go on to usmodernist.org, as I mentioned before, and email the heck out of George.
Yeah, right.
And he will.
I answer them all.
Direct you to the right place. I want to switch over to your podcast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all call you Mr. Modernism. You started this. You started this podcast world of mid-century modernism. Can you share with us some experiences or just... how many years have you been doing this again?
This is our ninth year.
Okay.
We've done about 320 shows. We've done about 500 guests. Mm-hmm. I was just there yesterday. We did four shows. We do them all back to back on Monday afternoons, kind of like by ritual. Because we do them in a recording studio that my co-host and engineer and partner, Tom Guild, is part of. So it gives us a lot of flexibility. It's like an old time radio station. We can have call-ins if we want.
Yes.
We can call out to the interviewees. We can have people in the studio. We can have musicians in the studio.
Yes.
So
I love it.
A number of the jazz guests that we have are actually live with us.
Yes.
And that's been, you know, super fun to do. You know, when I started it, there were maybe, I don't know, 150,000 podcasts. And now I think there are like 1.5 million podcasts. It's some zany number.
Yes, but you were voted number two.
Yeah.
You were voted number two, so hello.
Yeah,
that's
early on.
That's pretty, yeah.
Early on.
Kind of the godfather over here of this. But I love the show, and I have to tell you that it's such a fun time. I was so happy to be on it a couple times with you, and it's...
You're one of our first guests.
Well, you provide so much information to people, and you've been this avenue for everyone to learn. And you have these great giveaways. I remember you
gave giveaways, right?
I won, I think, one time. I won some books.
Yeah, during the pandemic.
Yes.
When we couldn't do a whole lot, you know, I get tons and tons of books brought to me. And so we just started giving away over Instagram.
That's amazing.
And that was fun to do.
That's great. Yeah, through COVID, I remember it was a fun thing to listen to. And everyone that was sitting at home and quarantining alone, that was just such a fun thing to be a part of. So
yeah,
I love that. I think, are you doing any more with the giveaways?
We haven't done those in a while.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe time to bring that.
At our local events in North Carolina, we give away a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, I have three tubs full of very expensive architecture coffee table books. They're like, I probably got $3,000 of coffee table books in tubs. And in July, when we have our Matsumoto Prize Awards for the best new architecture in North Carolina, we will give them away as door prizes. On everyone's name tag, there'll be a number, and we'll draw numbers out of the hat. And a lot of people will walk off with expensive coffee table books.
I love it. That's so fun. How many homes have you saved? Do you even know at this point?
Well, it's hard to, you know, it depends on how you qualify by save. But we think we've helped about 400 houses change hands in North Carolina just by marketing them and advertising them earlier. One of the real structural issues around the United States still is that the real estate associations have one category in their MLS, and it's called contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, they put everything they don't understand or it looks weird.
Right.
And they just dump it in there. It could be a yurt. It could be an igloo. It could be a Frank Lloyd Wright house.
That
whatever
all sums it up in it's contemporary.
Just throw it into contemporary.
Oh, my God.
Which means it's... you know, a needle in a haystack to try to search.
Right.
Now, in our area, we helped persuade the Raleigh-Durham MLS to start a modernist category.
Yes.
The funny thing was, people still classify yurts as modernist, but we now have a way of like contacting the realtors yes. and say, no, this is not a modernist house. This is a very beautiful right. contemporary house, or it's something mm-hmm. that had an addition put onto it and kind of set them straight. The really interesting ones are the ones in the Northeast, primarily, where realtors will be told by their client that Frank Lloyd Wright designed their house, which he did not.
That's right.
So they'll start advertising this
everywhere.
As a Frank Lloyd Wright discovery, and I have to call them up, the realtor, with the bad news, like architecture cop.
Yes.
And say, I'm sorry, ma'am.
You're the modernist police.
Right.
Excuse me, ma'am. You have the wrong designation yeah. on your listing.
Yeah.
You know, a realtor needs to, all realtors listening, please go to your MLS and petition. So I remember I petitioned to add Eichler onto MLS in 2009. And it took me 4 months to get them just to listen to me to add it. But it's very simple for them to add yeah. the category.
Yeah, it is.
It took 2 days. So please reach out to the local MLS and just say, hey, there are this many number of homes here. Please add the category. It should be very simple.
But well, this might be a good time to tell people what a modernist house is.
Right. Well, a modernist house, we look at the years. If it was built in 1955 to 1974, if it has a flat roof, all glass in the back, post and beam construction, you have a modernist house.
Yeah.
For people that have, you know, A-frame craftsmen with a lot of glass in it, you know, that's not it. A lot of people will not know what their home is. People have called and have said, you know, I think I live in an Eichler, but it might be a Mackie home or it might be a Stoneson. So yeah. no one really has that no. much information about them.
No, they use our site to do their due diligence. The buyers, the sellers, the closing attorneys, even, mm-hmm. You know, the mortgage brokers, the appraisers use this a lot, that they don't want to admit it.
Right. Yes. You're a valuable asset. Well, you can go to the title company. I always tell people that call in wondering what their home is. You can ask a title company. You can go to Chicago Title or Old Republic Title, and you ask them to do a special search where they can look up the architect and the builder. And they normally will have that record. Eichler, oddly enough, only had one neighborhood that is on title. It's in Saratoga here in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So those are the only homeowners that know for sure. But you usually can find that with yeah. them.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, we're able to do most of our house detective work by tracking down the children of the original owners. Because the owners
you've done this many, many times.
Oh, hundreds of times.
And I always laugh when I think of these people getting a call from you or getting an email.
Yeah, and they're really receptive. You know, to a person, they loved growing up in these houses. These houses were just amazing for children, generally. Yes. And they have such great memories, and they're very, very sad if the house has been sold or torn down or turned into an Italianate villa or mm-hmm. any of these kinds of things. And they remember, like, oh yeah, I remember meeting Richard Neutra when I was 7 in 1964, and he was walking around our house and talking to my mother. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a guy the other day who lived in a Gunnar Burkert's house in Michigan, a very famous mm-hmm. Michigan architect. And he was telling me all about how his mother got involved in the design of the interiors and how, you know, they ultimately had to sell it, but he was very sad about having to do that.
Mm.
And yeah. they remember the initial details. And once we get that, we can, you know, piece some of it together. The builders don't have very good records at all. Most builders never make it past 20, 30 years of business. They just come on the scene and then go away. They don't continue from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. And their archives go in the trash can, basically. There's no institutions that are saving construction company records.
That's right. Well, that's what happened when a friend of mine, Scott, told me that Stantec was throwing out Eichler plans. I had to call them right away and say, hey, these are really valuable. I know not many people think so, but there is a small community of us who they are very important for. So I think you have saved so much information, and without you, we would not have links to the past like we do. So I want to thank you so much for doing your work and for being this kind of a puzzle piece.
But we have a great team. We have volunteers that have been with us now like 12, 14 years, week after week after week. We have an excellent staff. We have two archivists who work with us now that help organize this material and put it together and create new sort of software side things for the website. One of the lessons that I've learned is when the phone rings, I answer it. And
are people surprised that you answer it?
That they're surprised anyone answers, really, because they're used to getting somebody's voicemail who never ever calls them back.
Oh, right. Right.
So, because, for instance, I got a call from the grandson of a semi-famous architect in New York. He got published quite a bit in the 60s and 70s, but never made it to that sort of A-level status that a lot of people did. Mm-hmm. Turns out his mother lived on Long Island and had her basement for the last 40 years filled with his grandfather's stuff. Just sitting there. And he was starting to get worried, like, what's going to happen to all this? Mm-hmm. And so he had called a couple of institutions. He called the grandfather's school, and they said, oh, yeah, well, we'll have to look at it. We'll have to think about it, whatever. And they called, you know, some of the museums. Nobody would call him back. So he calls me, and I said, we'll have someone up there in a week. So we flew somebody up there, and with a scanner, one of our archivists, and she went through the basement and basically did an assessment and found all the project lists and as many photographs as we could, scanned all those. So now we have enough information to be able to follow the trail and locate all the house projects. Are they still standing? Were they modified? Who owns them now? You know, have they gotten any kind of special status along the way? Wow. And it's really, you know, speed is a huge competitive advantage, even in nonprofits, because if you don't act quickly, opportunities just fly
by. They're gone.
Yeah.
They're gone. Absolutely. You have to act fast. I'm so happy that you're doing that.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And it's very fun, too. It's kind of like you're the Navy SEALs of modernism, you know, just jump on a plane and parachute down into a basement in Long Island.
Yeah. Your helicopter is just right. You're coming out of a helicopter.
Right.
You know,
I want to rappel out of one day with a scanner on my back, you know.
Yeah.
And go down and...
I can see it. Well, yeah. You do that a lot, actually. I've seen you rappel down. What was that thing in Singapore you rappelled down?
Oh, we took a group to Dubai.
That's right. Dubai.
And I did a zip line through downtown Dubai.
Those of you that are listening, please go to George's Facebook or Instagram and look at
Instagram,
this video.
Mr. Modernism. Oh. You can find my 3-minute flight ziplining.
It's priceless. I looked at that and I laughed out loud when I saw that. That was so great. But that sums up your personality and you in this modernist community. You are that to us. Thanks for, you know, taking the risks and for jumping out of airplanes and taking and being that force in our community.
You know, it's really important because you've got to help people change their thinking about preservation. Besides this waiting that people do and not going into action when a house goes vacant, there's a lot of things they think are true that aren't. Getting your house on the National Register of Historic Places means zero for saving it. Getting a historic designation from your state or town or county means nothing. Having a famous architect means nothing. Having a famous owner means nothing. The only legal way to protect a house from being torn down is something called a preservation easement, which is essentially a homeowners association for one house. So most people are familiar with homeowners associations. It's a document that runs a whole neighborhood. Well, this is a document that you get an attorney to write up for you yourself. It just governs one house. Mm-hmm. And what it essentially does is says that if there are going to be changes to the house, it has to be done consistent with the original style. Mm-hmm. So you can't glum on something foreign to a modernist house. It also has qualifications for what happens in natural disasters. So if a house is damaged, say a tree falls on it, knocks out 20% of the house, you've got to put it back like it was. But if an earthquake comes along and takes out 80% of the house, then you would be off the hook and you could put back whatever you wanted. Very reasonable kind of constrictions. Mm-hmm. But this document rides with the deed and is enforceable forever. Mm-hmm. So it assures that the house is going to live on.
Yes. So I'm sure that's different, you know, for each state. They would have to have, you know, someone take care of that legally for that state and then go to their title company.
For every state, there's usually a state preservation organization that is the perpetual care, if you will, for the house. So they're the ones that would police the house in the future if some future owner did something wrong. But the people who buy these houses, buy them knowing that there's a preservation easement in place and like that.
Yes.
Because they generally don't regulate what happens inside the house. If you want to update bathrooms or kitchens or put in whatever tech you want, that's all fine. It's just to keep the thing from being sort of beat up on the outside or, you know, scraped away and stucco sprayed all over it and all the kind of horrible things that we see happen to modernist houses.
Oh, yeah. Pillars being put in the front, you know, white picket fences and all these horrible things that people do.
Yeah. Nothing about white picket fences. It's just not the same vibe. I mean, it would be like, you know, if we had a Cape Cod that was cantilevered, that would not be true to the Cape Cod style.
Right, right. It's kind of the anti-Cape Cod.
Yeah.
Correct. Well, I think that's a call to action for people to reach out and have that document. I know that people that do love modernist architecture do like that they're protected.
Mm-hmm.
And they often search for resources to do the right thing for the home. So that's the next step. When you have that done, you have to have the right people in place that can help you make, you know, changes that you prefer.
Right. Finding skilled people is not often the easiest.
Mm-hmm.
The question I get asked all the time is, how do I pick an architect for my restoration or my new modernist house? And the answer I always tell them is, that's not your problem.
Right.
I haven't run into an architect yet who couldn't restore a modernist house or design a new one.
Right.
And they can all do that fine. The issue is the builder. You know, does the builder have the skills of working in these materials of steel and, you know, storefront glass and interesting kinds of things that are not just stick-built development kind of houses? And every builder, you know, your cousin Earl will tell you, oh, yeah, I can do that, no problem. But Earl can't do that very well.
No, he can't.
He just can't. So the critical thing is to be asking the architect what builders they worked with before. Mm-hmm. And this is a new wrinkle. Have those builders in the early conversations of the design so they can be telling you like, oh, you know, we can't get that oak anymore. It's like $1,000 a square foot or something
now.
So they can help guide the early decisions. So the time you get to the estimating stage, it's going to be less expensive than it would be otherwise.
Right.
This is accomplished when you're working with a design build architect, where they are the architect and the builder too. So, which is a plus for the client because you never have to worry about arguments between your architect and your builder. They're the same person.
Right, the same person. So you can be mad at one person.
Right, just one. Just one.
You don't need to be mad at multiple people.
Right.
Just yell at the one person.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite part about doing this work?
Well, I love solving all the Scooby-Doo mysteries. That's just great. You know, figuring out from very tiny clues if a house is still around, where it is, what happens to it, and then wrapping that up kind of like a cold case from 1954 is a thrill.
Yes.
To do that over and over. But the best things are the conversations that I have with people who grew up in the houses or who aspire to have the houses or who have some very heartfelt connection to modernism other than just a place to stay. Most people who don't like modernism or who think it's weird or foreign or communist or whatever have never spent a couple nights in a modernist house. So they don't really know the vibe that they get. And so one of the frequent questions I get is, you know, my spouse is not into this and I am. How do I persuade them? And I tell them, go on Airbnb or VRBO and find a kick-ass modernist house somewhere and go spend a weekend and expose your spouse to this lifestyle and what it's all about. Because all they're basing their judgment on generally is just the outside of the house and how different it is from everything else in the neighborhood, right? Occasionally, they tell me stories where the spouse grew up in a neighborhood where they were really weird people in a modernist house, and that kind of, you know, colored their perception of the architecture.
Well, we are weird people.
Yeah.
I mean, we're...
But like really weird.
I know we're... No, but I mean all of us, usually a lot of us are just weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have to accept that. I mean,
right.
And embrace it, George.
So the Airbnb weekend is a great strategy for getting people going.
Yes.
The other thing is that most people who are not familiar with modernism don't realize how much modernism has affected every house that's being built now.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in the 50s, the idea of what's called open concept now, right?
Right.
That was radical in the 50s.
Yes.
It's like, radical. Oh my God, having the living room flow into the dining room, flow into the kitchen. Oh my God.
Where are all the walls?
Yeah.
What's happening?
Like, where's the privacy between this? Like, smells from the kitchen will go into the living room.
I can see you on the other side. Yeah.
Right. This was radical.
Yes.
But it came about because of central air and heating.
Mm-hmm.
That allowed that to take place. No longer did you have to have lots of little tiny rooms that were fueled by oil heat or coal, and they'd have doors so you could close the door in the winter and not have to heat that room. And there were all kinds of economic reasons why the designs were this way. Mm-hmm. But central air opened that up. It's now open floor plans are in almost every single house is built, no matter what the style is.
That's right.
You've got that in place. That's been affected quite a bit.
That's right.
The idea of floor-to-ceiling windows. Mm-hmm. Almost every house that's built now has a sliding glass door somewhere on it, on the back, usually, or other kinds of large windows. The idea of skylights have been, you know, seeping into more and more houses over time.
Mm-hmm.
They went out of favor in the 70s because modernism went out of favor in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone thought that you can't buy a flat-roofed house because it's going to leak.
Right.
Because some of them did leak.
Right.
But then material science caught up with architecture and made rubber membrane roofs and other kinds of roofs, which are just, you know, wonderful and last 30 years. And you don't have the issues you have with those old tar paper and gravel roofs, which were really terrible.
Right. Well, it was bigger is better then, and just, I think, the wrong way of thinking. Now, after the pandemic, we've all come back to this beautiful, you know, let's live in a home that shows us nature. Let's, you know, be a little bit more minimalist. I think that has come back in a huge way. And if you look at the price per square foot for modernist homes, it's much higher than traditional style homes.
Right. It is.
Yeah.
Particularly when they're in good shape.
That's right. That's the main goal. So thank you so much, George.
You're welcome. What a pleasure.
I mean, this has been a dream come true, and I can't thank you enough. After 9-10 years of working together, here we are. We're finally here, and I'm so honored to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.